It's an honor and a joy to be with so many people who believe in divine mercy. In the few minutes I have this afternoon, I want to try to communicate to you that you really can't be pro-life or understand how to win the battle of life if you do not understand divine mercy. As was mentioned, I have been 44 years actively involved in the cause of life, since 1967. And I guess it was in every aspect of the pro-life movement. We tried to stop the passing of the law in New York City, New York State, 1970. We were involved in organizing the first March for Life in Washington, D.C., January 22nd, 1974. I was one of the first ones in the country to withhold taxes. We primed the pump, and eventually a young congressman from Illinois put an amendment on appropriations bill. His name was Henry Hyde. Became known as the Hyde Amendment. But people do not realize there was a lawyer called Larry Washburn. Immediately after that amendment was placed on the bill, an injunction was placed on the amendment. It was useless. At that time, 450,000 abortions were being paid for a year by United States taxpayers' monies. And Larry Washburn, for the next 2 years, he gave up his job on Wall Street, lost his home, pro bono, argued the case. And he had been my lawyer in 1973 when I withheld my taxes. So the first one on the stand, of course, was Monsignor Riley. And my tax forms went to the Supreme Court of the United States. And ultimately, we won that decision, 1980, 5-4. But the killing continued. It's interesting, in 1967, I gave a talk at Incarnation Parish, and I said to the people, I said, you know, they're trying to pass a law to legalize the killing of the child in the womb. And after the mass, the people came up to me and said, Monsignor, are you okay? Is something the matter with you? I said, you can never pass a law to allow the children in the womb to be killed. This is America. In 1987, I gave a talk, and I said, we have to pass a law to protect all the children in the womb. And after the mass, the people came up to me and said, Monsignor, are you okay? There's no way to pass a law to protect all the children in the womb. This is America. And then it hit me clearly what our Holy Father Pope John Paul II was speaking about. We had gone from a culture of life where it was unthinkable to have a law to allow the children in the womb to be killed, to a culture of death where it was unthinkable that you should pass a law to stop all the killing of the children in the womb. Well, they were wrong the first time, because we did pass the law. And they're wrong the second time, because we will once again outlaw abortion. But you can't depend upon the law. We are in a culture of death. And so it was after 22 years I came to the awareness, I cannot do it. You cannot do it. And I told God, I give up. It's impossible. He said, you're a thick Irishman. It only took you 22 years to realize you can't do it, but I can. And so after 22 years, I said, okay, God, you do it. Give me an army. He said, okay. He gave me 3 grandmothers, 1 grandfather, and 1 working girl. He said, now take your army and go. I said, this is the army to conquer a culture of death? He said, look, Monsignor, if I give you any more, you will think that you're doing it, not I. Just take your army and go. And so I went. And we went, and the only thing we used was we went out in the Feast of Our Lady of the Rosary. Great Battle of Ponto, Our Lady of Victory. The source of when St. Pius V, when the Ottoman Empire was about to take over Europe, the great armada was coming. They had no way to defeat that armada. And so they turned, as he did, to his Dominican roots, and he began to say the rosary. And he asked everybody to say the rosary. And as you know, we won. And he attributed to Our Lady as a victory because of the rosary. Later it was turned into the Feast of Our Lady of the Rosary. And it was on October 7th that we came to the point where we said that there's no place in the world that we could turn to. This culture of death is sweeping the world. Who are we going to turn to? There's no free world to come in to save us. We have to, like St. Pius V, go outside this world. We have to go to the source which is not of this world. We have to go to Our Lady and to He who is mercy itself. And once we did that, everything changed. And I didn't ask to go anywhere. And of course, I have gone from five people to the five continents of the world. On Monday morning, I asked you to keep you in your prayers. I am going to South Korea. They've asked me to come. And I say to you, it's against the law to have an abortion in South Korea. But proportionally, they have as many abortions in South Korea as we do. Right? Because it's the culture, it's the mentality. And that has to be changed, as you have to learn and understand. And the divine mercy is incredibly important. We did a prayer vigil this morning in San Diego, and there were four people turned around and kept life while we were there. Right? But people are really beginning to bring God's divine mercy. You know, I know from experience. Okay? I have been 5 days a week, 4 to 5 hours a day, sometimes 6 hours a day, counseling outside abortion clinics every day. And I know the power of the divine mercy chaplet. I'll give you a simple example. On Saturday, I usually go to a number of different places because in New York City, which is the abortion capital of the world, we have people praying outside these places all the time. And I go from place to place and encourage the people. And I arrived this Saturday morning, and Emily, a retired pharmacist, one of the counselors, she came over to me and she said, Monsignor, you see that young man outside the door there? He just brought his girlfriend inside. Go over and tell him to get him out. So I said, Emily, I just got here. I know, but you go over there and tell him to take out his girl. So I went over to him. I said, what kind of a man are you? I said, your child is at risk right now. Are you going to stand by this woman? Are you going to defend this child? You have to go in there and get her out. We will help you. Throw away that cigarette. Go inside. Right? And so he looked at me. He was shocked. He threw away the cigarette and went inside. I came over to the prayer group because we were out in the street. I came on the prayer group. I said, look, I need prayers now. I just told that guy to go inside. We had a very big prayer group right there. They said, Father, okay. About 60 people. They all fell on their knees and they began the Divine Mercy Chaplet. And while they are praying, and I am praying with them because they're inside this whole barrier, and I'm coming, this guy comes out and he taps me on the shoulder. I turn around and said, I told you to go inside and get the girl. Yeah. He said, yeah, I know. I said, well, go. He said, I got it. Here she is. While I'm talking to her, another couple came out. She's crying. They brought him over to me. Now I'm talking to two couples, same time. I'm talking to the two. Another couple came out. I have three couples. I'm talking to three at the same time. I turned around to the prayer group and I said, slow down, I can't handle it. You know, every day before I go, I'm 4, 5, 6 hours outside this abortion clinic, big ones, yeah? Every day, I say, all right, Lord, it's the time for the Divine Mercy Chaplet. He spoils me rotten. Always somebody comes out. Every day. Every day, right? Because this is key. This is key to understanding what it's about. Right? The Divine Mercy Chaplet. So I say to you, you are for Divine Mercy? Wonderful. I'm going to try to explain to you where you must bring this mercy. Who needs this mercy, okay? You know, I was coming back from Europe, Eastern Europe, and You know, you would have to be these days blind or deaf, not to read in the newspapers or radios or watch on TV the unrelenting attack by so many commentators on the Catholic Church. It's going on for years in the United States, but more recently in Western Europe, in Ireland, for the shameful deeds of a few. But one commentator went so far as to say, this may be the end of the Catholic Church. And I thought to myself, you foolish man, it is not the end of the Catholic Church, but rather of Western civilization, whose flawed leaders, by misusing words such as freedom, choice, equality, have anesthetized the people into passively accepting the removal from the laws of the land all Judaic and Christian values. And without these ethical foundations, Western civilization will collapse and perish into barbarism. For it was the implementing of the moral values found in God's commandments and the recognition in law of the absolute value of every human life created by God that made the laws in Western civilization great and admired. You know, the late Archbishop Fulton Sheen, he said that it's a characteristic of any decaying civilization that the great masses of the people are unconscious of the tragedy. Humanity in a crisis is generally insensitive to the gravity of the times in which it lives. Men do not want to believe their own times are wicked, partly because they have no standard outside of themselves by which to measure their times. If there's no fixed concept of justice, how shall men know it is violated? Only those who live by faith really know what is happening in the world. The great masses without faith are unconscious of the destructive processes going on because they have lost the vision of the heights from which they have fallen. Country after country, through the legalization of abortifacient contraceptives, abortion, euthanasia, embryo stem cell research, therapeutic cloning, and on, is institutionalizing a structure of sin and death. Organizations such as the European Union and the United Nations are too often becoming the problem and not the answer due to certain powerful people and groups who manipulate even these institutions into implementing their worldwide culture of death agenda. And thus, tragically today, the light of life for far too many innocent human beings is going out, especially across America and Western Europe, without a whimper from the majority. This light has been dimmed ever so slowly so that many, without realizing it, have acclimated themselves to live in moral darkness. Others are already despairing of the hope of a new dawn, while those being born into the darkness accept it as the normal condition. Where and to whom can the people of the world turn to find vision and hope and light for this world and its people? The evangelist John, he tells us the answer in the very beginning of his gospel by unveiling for us the moment that eternity broke into time, into the human condition. St. John tells us that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God, and all things came to be through Him. Without Him, nothing came to be. And what came to be through Him was life. And this was the light of the human race. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it, and it will not overcome it. We have to bring Christ to this problem. We have to bring He who is the light of the world where there is darkness. You know, more than 25 years ago, Eileen Egan, she wrote a book about Mother Teresa of Calcutta, and she entitled it, Such a Vision of the Street. The words of the title are taken from the prelude of the English poet T.S. Eliot. The more complete quote is, Such a vision of the streets as the streets hardly understands. Eileen Egan was making the point that many people viewing in the streets the sisters of Mother Teresa's religious order, they see them as good humanitarians, social workers, reaching out to the unwanted, the outcast of society. But Mother Teresa, with the eyes of faith, she saw her sisters as Jesus doing acts of kindness to Jesus, hidden in the distress and disguise of the poor, the unwanted, the outcast. A totally different vision of the same experience. Today, we were out in the street, and many a passerby, including some pro-lifers, might have viewed the helpers outside the abortion clinic today simply as pro-life protesters of legalized abortion, demonstrators or some people praying primarily to save the innocent, unwanted, unborn infants whose lives today were at risk of a violent death. To view the helpers simply as people on the pro-life side versus the abortion side, in a struggle primarily to save the unborn babies, would be hardly to understand the helpers on the street. Only with the eyes of faith, in the light of Golgotha or Calvary, can the scene on the street or the helper's mission be properly understood. May I relate to you a story about Joey that could illustrate this, that could bring home what I'm trying to say. Joey was miraculously converted at a Bowery mission from a hopeless life of addiction and became a humble, loving servant of all that would come to that mission. No task was beneath him. He did everything with love. And one evening at a mission prayer service, a repentant drunk came down the aisle to the altar, and he knelt to pray, and he cried out for God to help him, to change him. And he kept shouting, Oh God, make me like Joey. Make me like Joey. And the minister at the mission, he leaned over and he said to the man, Son, I think it would be better if you prayed, make me like Jesus. The repentant drunk, he looked up at the minister with a quizzical expression on his face and he asked, Is Jesus like Joey? The helper's goal is to change the hearts of the people approaching the abortion mill by letting them find or see Jesus in us. It means we have to remove from ourselves and the group any type of presence that the person approaching the abortion mill would view us as confrontational, judgmental, or self-righteous. To do this, we need to pray and to fast. We need the grace of God, and we need the guidance and intercession of Mary, the Mother of God, the Mother of Jesus, to help us, her spiritual children in Christ, to become like Jesus. You see, the only place people are going to meet Jesus is in you. I think we fail to realize that. The risen Christ is not tired, but he wants to do the work of his Father. But he only can do it through his mystical body, through you, the church. And if the world can't find Jesus, it's because we're not witnessing Jesus. They have to find Jesus in us. And we have to go where Jesus would go if he was here today. Where would he go? He'd go to Calvary. He'd go to Golgotha. He'd go to the place where they want to kill him. Because those people need Jesus. The helpers of the vision then, namely of being Jesus on the street, is based on the great mystery of Christianity. Namely that the risen Christ intends and does continue to do the work of his Father through you and through me. He asks permission to live within us and through us to extend his mercy to those enslaved in the culture of death. The challenge of the helpers then is not to be protesters, but to be roadside or sidewalk contemplatives at Calvary or Golgotha. The challenge is to remove from our presence outside of these places anything that would prevent those going there for an abortion from experiencing in us the unconditional, merciful love of God for them. You go there primarily to save the people who are having the abortions, who work there. You go there because of the people who are caught in the culture of death. You do not go there primarily to save babies. Jesus went to Golgotha to die for the people who are going to put him to death. The last commandment he saved to us was, love your enemies. I'll give you the power to do so. But we know we're incapable of doing this unless God gives us the power to love even our enemies as Jesus did. But thanks be to God. God has given us the power to love those who reject us, who even hate us. The power is called the virtue of charity. Thus, for the helpers involved in the struggle of restoring respect, of restoring a culture of life, there's no longer two sides, as the media loves to project, namely pro-life versus pro-abortion. For the helpers now, there's only one side. We are commissioned by God as a people to be faithful ambassadors of the merciful, unconditional, everlasting love of Christ for all those coming to the modern day Golgothas or Calvaries, which tragically is not far today where any one of us lives. Even more important than being at the abortion clinics is the challenge of being there in the right way. The ones who example teach us best how to be at our modern day Calvaries, of course, is Mary, the mother of Jesus, and John, and the beloved disciples, and the holy woman who at the foot of the cross, and above all else, Jesus, who hung on the cross. You know, when a woman who's had an abortion asked the question of me, could God ever truly love me again? My response is rather simple and straightforward. Mom, God never stopped loving you. It is we who turn away from God. It is we who become enemies of God, but God never became an enemy of you. When the whole world was broken and estranged from God in the person of Jesus Christ, God, in his unconditional, merciful love, came into the human condition and freely offered his life in our place in reparation for our sins and those of the whole world. A great physical evil is done to the unborn aborted child, but the unborn child never committed a moral evil in its short life here on earth. For me, it's clear that the child, having placed no obstacle in the way of grace, in the way of the gift of divine life, that child goes directly to God. However, those involved in the abortion are committing a great moral evil that put at risk their eternal salvation. Following an abortion, the people involved, especially the mothers, experience low self-esteem, depression, despair. Some are so blinded by this culture of death, they just don't appreciate the wrongness of what they're doing until after the abortion has taken place. It's then especially that they need to experience the unconditional, merciful love of God. The mission of the helpers, indeed, of many pro-lifers outside abortion mill, is primarily to save souls, not simply to save the physical life of the unborn. It's to make present to all this unconditional love of God. This is why we teach the helpers to be Christ to the people before and after an abortion. That is why I'm there 5 to 6 hours a day. Because I speak to the woman not only before the abortions, I speak to them after the abortions.